I think it's a very far fall to go from a fisheries aide to a senator to someone who's going to be serving time at a federal penitentiary.
Arne Fugelvog is sentenced to 5 months in prison. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Lance Mackey takes the lead in the Yukon Quest.
I'm always pretty confident in what I'm driving, and this year has been a little bit sketchy because I got a bunch of young dogs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Arne Fugelvog was sentenced in federal court this morning. The former North Pacific Fishery Management Council member and former fisheries aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski, who was convicted of illegal fishing, will receive 5 months in federal prison. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports from Anchorage.
Arne Fugelvog sat quietly, almost meekly, before Judge H. Russell Holland to hear his sentencing. Fugelvog had pleaded guilty to one count of a Class A misdemeanor violation of the Lacey Act. The plea deal with federal attorneys could have gotten him a 10-month sentence, but both federal attorney Ani Stewart and Fugelvog's counsel Jeff Feldman had asked the court for a lesser sentence. Judge Holland said any monetary gain by Fugelvog was overshadowed by the damage done to public perception of the ethics of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Holland said, quote, Mr. Fugelvog was in a position of responsibility and influence and has damaged the North Pacific Fishery Management Council more than damaged any environmental resources. Ani Stewart, assistant U.S. attorney, said she's satisfied with the sentence. She had asked that the courtroom be cleared when Judge Holland asked her why she had requested a lighter prison term. Holland would not clear the court, and Stewart would only say that Fugelvog was still cooperating with authorities on another case that is not finished yet.
His cooperation is still ongoing at this time.
Fugelvog's attorney, Jeff Feldman, told the court his client's remorse is sincere. Stewart remarked that the sentence is fair and just.
I think Mr. Fugelvog is sincerely upset by the situation he finds himself now and has no one to blame but himself. I think it's a very far fall to go from a fisheries aide to a senator to someone who's going to be serving time at a federal penitentiary. And I do think he is sincerely regretful for the choices he made that have landed him in that situation.
The fishing violations Fugelvog pled guilty to spanned several years, although the charge and plea agreement focus on Fugelvog's 2005 violations aboard one vessel, when he doubled his quota in one reporting area by reporting fishing in a different area. In comments to the court, Fugelvog's voice broke when he told the judge, quote, I am deeply sorry for actions that burdened the agencies I had vowed to serve. Stewart says the sentence needs to be a deterrent to others. Otherwise, the system won't work. She says it was a serious offense.
It went on for a long period of time, from at least 2001 to 2006. And the defendant tried to frame it in terms of just a time savings and not the motivation not being necessarily money. But the government believes that time is money in the fishing industry, and that not only was Mr. Fugelvog saving time when he cut corners and falsely reported where he caught fish, but that did equate to him, you know, having a gain in money as well.
Fugelvog attorney Feldman would not comment after the proceeding, saying only that it is not clear yet when Fugelvog will have to report to prison. Fugelvog also declined to comment. As part of the terms, Fugelvog will pay a $50,000 fine and a $100,000 community service payment. The defendant will also be required to place an ad in the National Fisherman alerting others to his circumstances. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Both sides are appealing a Superior Court judge's ruling in the Alaska redistricting suit. A mixed decision issued last week by Judge Michael McConaughey remanded four districts proposed by the Alaska Redistricting Board back for reworking. That includes House Districts 37 and 38, which incorporate Western Alaska and Interior communities in an attempt to protect the strength of the Alaska Native vote as required by the Federal Voting Rights Act. The Alaska Redistricting Board voted today to seek review of Judge McConaughey's ruling that the sprawling district should be reworked to better comply with state and federal law. Redistricting Board Executive Director Taylor Bickford says appeals are part of the redistricting.
There's never been a case that didn't have districts thrown out at the trial court level. There's never been a case that didn't have certain aspects of that decision then appealed to the Supreme Court. And there's actually never been a case that that made it to the Supreme Court and then didn't have certain aspects of the plan rejected at that level. So it's really part of our process in redistricting in Alaska is this legal process.
The redistricting maps are drawn with public input by a governor-appointed board. Allegations of partisan manipulation are standard, but Judge McConaughey rejected gerrymandering claims in his decision. Plaintiffs disagreed. Attorney Mike Wallery, who represents two Fairbanks area voters who sued to block the plan, says their appeal is based on concerns about fair representation for Fairbanks. Wallery says the proposed plan protects local Republican legislative incumbents while pitting two Fairbanks Democrats against one another in a new district.
The pairing of the Democratic senators, Pascavant and Thomas, at the same time that Mr. Coghill and Ms. Wilson remained in their, in quote, their districts, and were not drawn out of their districts, we think is basically unfair.
Wallery says his clients are getting financial and in-kind legal assistance in the case from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The Alaska Supreme Court has blocked out time in mid-March to hear the appeals in the redistricting case. A finalized map of voter districts has to be ready for the June 1st candidate filing deadline. A southeast town continues to watch 5 acres of residential land slowly migrate downhill toward the ocean. As Tara Bicknell reports from Haines, the emergency situation is growing to involve state and federal assistance.
The borough of Haines on Friday declared the mass wasting of land on the waterfront a disaster and is requesting further assistance to house displaced residents, repair basic infrastructure, and figure out why land continues to creep along with roadways and homes in its path. Borough Manager Mark Ernest explained to government officials and residents gathered at a special assembly meeting Friday afternoon that the borough is requesting the governor's office to declare a disaster emergency as described in state statute and to provide disaster assistance to the borough in its response and recovery from the ongoing event.
It's just got to the point now where it's really exceeding our ability to deal with this.
The shifting earth was first discovered last month when workers found cracks in the road and has since grown to involve about 5 acres of waterfront land. On it are roads that lead to the town's shipping port and ferry terminal.
The immediate concern was for the protection of life and property.
About 5 homes are in the immediate vicinity of the slump. 2 have been evacuated. Others in the area are monitoring growing cracks in their homes and are experiencing changes in water pressure. Already, the borough has taken action to keep changing roadways maintained and open, rerouted power and cable utility lines, and performed emergency temporary repairs to the sewer utility main after it failed on Thursday. Geologists, engineers, water and sewer managers, emergency planners, and weather experts are all part of the conversation at this point to explain the reason for the midwinter ground shift. The resolution passed unanimously Friday by the Haines Assembly will allow the borough to seek funds from both federal and state programs. Reporting in Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new encyclopedia of Tlingit gets a cool reception in Sitka.
For those of us that have been studying Tlingit for 40 plus years, I think it was surprising to not have heard of her or her work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The state Senate plans to take a fast but completely fresh look at oil taxes when it begins work later this week on changes to the state's tax regime. A new bill that will be used to set up the plan will be introduced Friday morning and is already scheduled for a hearing in the Resources Committee that afternoon. Resources co-chair Joe Pascvan of Fairbanks says the bill will not present a specific plan, but will leave the details open for public debate.
Friday, I'm hoping to have the Department of Revenue spend its time defining what they perceive as the problem, hoping that they will not address, so to speak, their solution to the problem, but use their time to define the problem so you don't bury the problem in a solution.
Co-chair Bert Stedman says the state's consultants and representatives from the oil companies tell him that the main issue that needs to be addressed in any new bill is what's called the progressivity element. That's a variable tax rate that pays the state more as the price of oil increases. Senate President Gary Stevens says he expects to have the bill through both Senate committees in time to leave 30 days for the House to deal with the measure before the statutory end of the session. Bonanza Fuel in Nome has raised prices after last month's delivery through the ice. Gas is selling at $5.94 a gallon and diesel at $6.19. That's up from $5.43 and $5.93 a gallon. Sitnasoc Board Chair Jason Evans says the company was waiting until the icebreaker Healy and Russian tanker Renda were safely out of the ice before setting prices.
There was a small price increase in fuel based on our final delivery, but we also had to maintain prices consistent with what's happening in the market since there's another fuel supplier.
The slow trip through 400 miles of ice did not have a significant impact on the final bill to Sitnasoc. Evan says much of the agreement with Vitus Marine was decided before the month-long journey. Even with the unconventional delivery, Evan says Bonanza's new prices are close to what they expected with a scheduled barge shipment.
The price changes that took place were consistent with prices that we were looking at in the fall, had our barge arrived on schedule. So we are pricing consistent with what we thought we would be doing back in September and October.
The recent weeks of 30 below temperatures have led to Bonanza selling around 30% more home heating fuel than during a normal winter. To meet the higher demand for home heating fuel, Evans says a portion of the 1 million gallons of diesel from the Renda is being sold as heating fuel after being blended with existing inventories. Even with greater demand, Evans says local inventories should be adequate.
We feel comfortable that the amount of fuel in Nome now will get us through for the next barging season. And without that fuel delivery, we would have run out of different products by now, both gasoline and diesel. And then it was a matter of time until Crowley would have run out of fuel as well. But with the Renda delivery, Nome has adequate fuel supplies to get through till the next barging season.
The two vessels involved in the operation are finishing up the extended working season. The icebreaker Healy arrived in Seattle Sunday morning. Evan says the Renda is scheduled to arrive in Vladivostok this Friday. 200 households in Bethel will be receiving free heating fuel through Citgo. That's just a fraction of homes that received the donation last year. But as KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports, the program has gone through a lot of changes the past 5 years that it's been giving free fuel to Bethel.
In the first 2 years, all households in Bethel that paid for heating fuel could receive 100 gallons for free. In 2007, that was worth $450. In the third year, each household got $450 worth of fuel, which ended up being about 90 gallons as the prices had gone up. Last year, the heating program became income-based. Residents had to qualify for one of several needs or income-based programs. That still came out to 950 households in Bethel. This year, however, the program has been whittled down to just 200 vouchers. To qualify, residents must have received one of two types of low-income heating services from Ugusagagbut Native Council in Bethel, ONC. Those programs are the LIHEAP, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or the ACAP, the Alaska Heating Assistance Program.
This year, it's based on 200 families.
Bob Ngayek is the housing administrator for ONC. He says this year's CITGO funding is actually leftover money from last year.
You know, this is the fifth year, and in the past few years, you know, we've been hearing it could have been the last year, but, you know, last year we were hearing it could have been the last year, but now this came up again, but it's a much smaller program.
This year's donation will amount to approximately 80 gallons of fuel. And Guyuk says the Sitco program was great while it lasted, and people should be thankful for what they have already received.
It was a real good program, especially for us out here out in the outer areas where the price of fuel is very high. So this has helped quite a bit.
Sitco is a Venezuelan-owned company that has given free heating fuel to low-income communities all over the country. Alaska's program has been funneled through the Alaska Intertribal Council, with vouchers given out by local tribal groups. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Unusually heavy snows in south-central Alaska this year are hurting moose populations. Gary Olson is executive director of the Moose Federation. He says snow conditions are forcing moose into dangerous situations.
We put up two super cubs on Saturday. In a lot of the areas where the moose once were, there's just literally no tracks left. And there's large groups of moose in Willow, Big Lake, Point McKenzie, and a couple other areas where they're pretty much lumped together, and it's unfortunately adjacent to the railroad and the highway corridors.
Normally, feeding moose is illegal, but yesterday, state Fish and Game Department officials issued Olson's group permission to divert moose away from dangerous situations. Olson says his group is working with large landowners to plow trails for moose and to find places to set up feeding stations for the ungulates.
The permits that came in were, first and foremost, the permits on Matsu Burrow and DNR permits that allow us to make diversionary snow trails and the feeding program, cutting brush and such. And then the secondary permits that just came in was the permit to be able to feed moose under Fish and Game oversight, a selective haylage product that's grown locally out in Point McKenzie. And it is the same product that Fish and Game feeds their study moose in the Palmer area.
The Moose Federation plans to plow moose trails to feeding areas to keep the animals away from dangerous roadways.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Lance Mackey has taken the lead in the Yukon Quest sled dog race. He arrived at Eagle Checkpoint at 2:08 this afternoon, with Hugh Neff 1 minute behind. Alan Moore and Brent Sass are also resting at Eagle. Meanwhile, a second musher has dropped out of the race. Rookie Jason Weitzel of Two Rivers scratched back at Circle. Mushers in the race are logging a lot of miles on the Yukon River. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports from the Yukon Quest Trail, the river offers its own set of challenges.
The list of dangers that mushers might encounter on the Yukon River can seem nearly as long as the race itself. And if anyone knows what to watch out for, it's four-time champion Lance Mackey.
Pudgy sticks in the beaver dams are right out of here. Tight corners, deep snow, cracks in the ice. I mean, all of those things that we know are there. That don't mean we can always control the outcome of them.
The trail report isn't calling for anything dramatic. It does make mention of a few large cracks and some jumble ice. Brent Sass took some time to pack his sled with extra supplies before leaving Circle.
But Trail Creek not being open, it means that we're going to be camping on the river, which can be pretty treacherous if the wind's blowing and it's cold.
Trout Creek is a hospitality stop 42 miles outside of Eagle. For years, a local family has opened it to mushers, but the doors are shut this year and the wood stove stands cold. Veteran Sonny Lindner says he loaded his sled with extra food and fuel to help break up the 160-mile run into Eagle.
Kind of broke nicely before 60, 60, 40 or whatever it was, and this time it's 60 and 100.
There are 9 checkpoints along the Yukon Quest Trail today, but in 1984, the year Lindner won the inaugural race, there were only 6. The original checkpoints operated more like today's hospitality stops, including Slavin's Cabin in the Yukon-Darling National Preserve. No one is quite sure when Slavin's became an official dog drop, but this year, mushers cannot leave dogs behind. The Yukon Quest is re-evaluating its volunteer pilot program to make sure it's in compliance with federal regulations. So flights serving the Yukon Quest out of Slavin's have been grounded, which means dogs can't fly out.
Yeah, I think it's a huge problem that there's no dog drop.
That's Quest rookie Jake Berkowitz. He says the change forced him to leave a dog behind early in Circle.
This dog that I'm dropping here, I would definitely be taking if there was a dog drop in 60 miles. You know, it's a long, long way, you know. We basically have 320 miles with one opportunity to drop a dog here in the next, on our way to Dawson. So you definitely are being more conservative on who you're dropping. You know, dogs that we would normally take to slave-ins we're dropping now.
But Kyla Durham sees it differently.
I mean, I feel Trout Creek not being open affects me a lot more. Slave-ins meaning not being a dog doesn't change my plan. It means I can't drop a dog there. And I was going to carry straw anyway because I was going to take someone for like my second camp wife. And so in terms of like what I know I'm going to do, like that takes away something you might need maybe. You might need maybe to drop a dog. But like the Trout Creek thing is like definitely changing your plan.
And Lance Mackey says he planned ahead for the benefit of his dogs.
I'm always pretty confident in what I'm driving, and this year has been a little bit sketchy because I got a bunch of young dogs. I want to end on a positive note. If they have to go home, it'll be positive. I don't want them to get tired, wobbly, fall over, something like that, and then have to put them in the sled. There's nothing beneficial about that.
It's not abnormal to drop dogs throughout the race. Ideal temperatures in the day and night, as well as a relatively smooth trail, have resulted in fewer drop dogs this year. But Mackey says he's keeping a careful watch on his competitors' dog teams.
People don't realize that they did damage going over Eagle or Rosebud or Perch Creek, and it doesn't show up until this run out of here in the jumbleys. Normally it takes 2 or 3 days sometimes to see the signs of your mistakes or your, you know, damages, like I said. And I've been doing it long enough to know the signs.
Because American flights are not available for the Quest this year, dogs that are dropped in Eagle will be flown by a Canadian carrier to Dawson City in the Yukon. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Circle, I'm Emily Schwing.
A new encyclopedia of the Tlingit language has teachers in Sitka scratching their heads. The massive work by New Zealand scholar Sally Ann Lambert is extraordinarily detailed and the product of years of effort. The problem is, the language in the book is not recognizable by contemporary scholars or native Tlingit speakers. KCAW's Robert Woolsey explains.
In a world as small as that of Tlingit scholarship, the appearance of Sally Ann Lambert's Tlingit Word Encyclopedia, The Origin of Copper, came as quite a surprise. So did the appearance of Sally Ann Lambert, who traveled to Sitka in mid-January to launch the book. No one had heard of her, not the Alaska State Museum, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, or the very active group of Tlingit language teachers in the Sitka Native Education Program. Nancy Douglas is the cultural program director at the Sitka School District.
For those of us that have been studying Tlingit for 40 plus years and working with elders, I think it was surprising to not have heard of her or her work.
The Tlingit Word Encyclopedia is the second of 9 volumes planned by Lambert. Her first work, A Dictionary of Maori, was published a few years ago. Lambert was born in New Zealand but grew up in Samoa, where she developed an aptitude for language. Lambert turned her attention to Tlingit when she acquired a copy of a book by the late 19th, early 20th century ethnographer J.R. Swanton.
I think often I'm led spiritually, and I don't always make my decisions with the full knowledge of a situation. Basically, the book was given to me and with Tlingit Myths and Texts by John Swanton, and Tlingit language is fortunate to have that resource.
Swanton is indeed a classic early ethnography of Tlingit and a good starting point for the study of Tlingit culture from a Western perspective. The Origin of Copper is one of the stories he recorded, and Lambert uses it as a basis to parse the grammar and culture of the Tlingit. This probably wasn't the best strategy.
Okay. So Swanton couldn't hear many of the sounds in Tlingit, so he didn't write it. So she didn't speak them. Swanton didn't put tone marks in his writing, so she doesn't know where the tone marks go.
They never heard of it at that time.
Well, he didn't know how important it was.
This is Ethel Macnan, a retired teacher at the Sitka Native Education Program, or SNEP, and a fluent Tlingit speaker. Ann Johnson, the current lead teacher for SNEP and a fluent Tlingit speaker. And Robbie Littlefield, a non-native who has spent much of her adult life in the active study of Tlingit culture. We're sitting in the SNEP classroom around a copy of Lambert's Tlingit Word Encyclopedia, which comes with an audio CD. Littlefield plays it for Macnan and Johnson, who both learned Tlingit as children. Johnson and Macnan look at each other as the disc plays, shaking their heads. They try to pick out the occasional words, but to these elders who learned Tlingit at the knees of their parents and grandparents, this is gibberish. Macnan says the author of a book on the scale of the Tlingit Word Encyclopedia needs a twofold commitment.
You have to be a speaker of the language and a person who's doing the writing, you know, writing system, has to understand the writing system. Before you can develop a book without knowledgeable people that understand the language.
So, does that mean the Tlingit Word Encyclopedia is a waste? Lambert, who has no advanced degrees and no university position, admits that she produced the book outside the worlds of Tlingit culture and traditional academia. She says she was pulled to Tlingit by its polarity with the great cultures of South America. Her rationale for the huge investment in time and energy in the book may ultimately have little to do with whether or not it is accepted.
To some degree, I was trying to bring my mother and father back together through my Celtic heritage, because my father had a little French and my mother had a little Scottish. And I felt that they'd lost their culture and they'd lost their reason for being together. And I think that deep in my heart, I was looking for that family togetherness, and you know, I wanted to find that through language. I felt that that was what I could do.
Lambert's Tlingit Word Encyclopedia and her Maori Word Dictionary are both self-published under the imprint WE International, the innovator in indigenous language resources. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tara Bicknell in Haines, Ben Matheson in Nome, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.